WOWDLP Tacoma Park.
We hope you enjoyed Rise Up 20. This show brings out the kid in me every time. It's a program for young and old alike. This is Tom Xenakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake, and we are the hosts of the Artist Experience radio show.
Good morning. Artist Experience is an hour-long radio show dedicated to looking at art. We hope that Tom and I can introduce our listeners to what we've been looking at and help you when you visit the exhibit, create in your soul, in your experience, your own work of art. The Artist Experience radio program has a unique mission. We look into the inward experiences of engagement with art, and we desire to make them explicit, both in the creator and in you, our listeners.
Yeah.
Good morning, everyone. We hope you're having a great start to your day. We're going to get you juiced to talk about art as we do every other Saturday morning from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. This is Tom Xenakis, and I'm with Sheila Blake and with the host of the Art as Experience radio show.
Good morning. We have an Art as Experience page on our Facebook page, and we put images of the things we're talking about. If you could go to that page, it would be very great just for you to look at the images that at the same time that we're having this show. And you can also stream this program at tacomaradio.org, and we're also putting podcasts of this show on my website, sheilablake.com, and on artisexperience.com, so you can listen at any time. And the podcast can also be found on iTunes.
Well, the big question of the day this morning is, what is an artist's visual voice? Sheila and I will talk about the criteria that gives an artist their visual voice. This voice often evolves and develops in an artist's career and as they grow. It's not always easy to find it in some artists. Artists take years to find their visual voice. So we started the program with a recognizable voice in the world of opera, Maria Callas. This diva was known to be a singer not to hit every note all the time. It was the going thing. They knew that. But her extreme passion in her roles and how she used her voice to express this passion is what made her stand out as an opera singer. It took years to develop this for her, and it's much like visual artists. What makes their art stand out and be unique and personal? So today we're going to look at three exhibitions that are currently on in D.C. We're going to compare the artists' voices and look at their careers in conjunction with their current exhibitions.
So we're going to look at the work and career of Sean Scully, who's an Irish artist living and working in the U.S. and Germany. His work is currently in an exhibition titled Landline at the Hirshhorn Museum on the Mall in D.C. The exhibition goes on through February 2019. Scully's work spans decades and media as a painter, sculptor, printmaker, and poet. And it is a spectacular show.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
You've got to go see it. It's wonderful. We are also going to look at the artist Richard Tuttle. His current exhibition is at the Phillips Collection. The exhibition is titled Intersections, Richard Tuttle, It Seems Like It's Going to Be. Like Scully, Richard Tuttle is also a painter, sculptor, poet, assemblage, and installation artist. This enigmatic artist has this elaborate installation at the Phillips Collection. It takes a whole floor. It's off Massachusetts Avenue Northwest near DuPont Circle. Both these exhibitions are metro accessible. These artists just coincidentally are an amazing comparison. They're both in their 70s at the height of their careers, both still developing and both very famous, but they are like the giant and the sprite. And in that, they are both unforgettable and well worth the leap of faith it takes to enter into their work and their minds.
Well, we're going to also talk about the artist that we had on our previous show in discussion was Trevor Paglen, whose exhibition is also at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. It's Trevor Paglen, Sights Unseen. It's an unusual photographic exhibition and the highlight of the work in the artist's mid-career. We found that a Trevor Paglen exhibit is haunting and powerful, and it's also appropriate as it pertains to a voice, and he certainly had his. That exhibition is basically three kinds of bodies of work, which are related in many characteristic ways in subject, theme, and message. By using this artist as an example, on seeing his work, we can first outline the criteria of how an artist develops. So the show that we had 2 weeks ago also will be appropriate for this particular show on visual voice.
Yeah, the Trevor Paglen show is such a special opportunity to learn from someone with a curiosity and intelligence and the no-holds-barred exploration into the world of surveillance. What looks at first glance like lessons in technology turns out to be a clear and often beautiful presentation of what we can't see. I found the weakness in his work to be his claim as an artist, but the best part is how he made it so easy for me to understand what he's exploring. So maybe I really shouldn't complain.
Yeah, he was out there for sure. Well, Sheila, what about this visual voice? I mean, that's a term we use, and of course, it's almost sounds like it's about music, but it's about visuals. How do we define it? What aspects of this voice do you find easy or difficult for a visual artist?
Well, that's a question that requires some thought.
Okay, yeah, it does. So, it's a tough one.
I remember in art history, I couldn't really tell the difference between Van Gogh or Monet or Manet, for that matter. That humming of the slide projector the first thing in the morning made sleep just irresistible.
Oh, I could remember that.
Oh, God. I hardly learned a thing.
Oh, boy.
So I had to find little clues how I could remember the different artists, like Angra, his women had turbans, Rubens had voluptuous naked women, but so did Titian and Renoir. And yes, and within art movements, sometimes it was hard to discern a Vuillard from a Bonnard, one voluptuous lady from another, one black square from another. But now, all these years of looking later, I see these artists as very distinct, except occasionally when I can also be surprised by their similarities. It's like listening to classical music, Bach or Rachmaninoff, without having heard that particular piece of music before, you still know it's their music. So artists are always being influenced and then developing beyond their influences until they're just learning from their own art. It's like diving into a pond and then drying off afterwards, but you still have layers and layers of influences, both your own and other artists. Sometimes these artists' paths converge and their work can look very much like another artist, but then their paths diverge and finally they're only themselves. Many artists develop the particular way they have of applying paint, like handwriting, and the area they capture for themselves within an art movement. And some of them are very intentional about that. They sort of look at the scope of where contemporary artists are going and find a place for themselves. And in the case of the artists we're going to talk about, how they can remain really just famous and successful and outsiders.
You know, it's interesting you use the word handwriting, because when I think of an artist's visual voice, I think of that unique look or way of communicating, which is a kind of handwriting in this sense, of in a visual way. So what visually separates them from other artists is really an important thing, as you just mentioned. What message are they portraying? Is it unique? Is it different? The unique word is important here. How is their visual product and possibly their processes different from the rest of the field in some way? One's visual voice can develop from a host of influences, even from way back in a person's life, before they even began considering themselves as artists. I mean, one must identify themselves as an artist first, and in our case, as a visual artist. As a person begins to be immersed in making art and producing a body of work over time, this can develop into one unified visual statement in a variety of visual products. But here's some things I like to talk about and to contribute to your visual voice. Firstly, your upbringing and your experiences of possibly joy or even trauma. I mean, even as a child, that could come into your work later on. And possibly something on the DNA, like a malady or an emotional state ingrained in that person. And I was always thinking of Christy Brown, the Irish artist from the great movie with Daniel Day-Lewis, My Left Foot. And, you know, he had his cerebral palsy and, you know, he had that burden of this physicality in his work, and it kind of went through his writing. He also was a writer. I mean, that was kind of where his visual voice really came from. And then we have spiritual and religious events and experiences could be contributing factors. Application to old ideas from another art period in a new way, making the work contemporary. And of course, current events. Current events can create a visual voice. It spurs someone at that moment. This is particularly important in pop. And then media and techniques. Well, we saw Trevor Plaglen. He's using contemporary surveillance, you know, data and computers and technology. So this is important, too. But what is current and what is progressive might contribute to a visual voice. In other words, you're in the stream of other art movements and you just kind of piggyback along, and that spurs on your own visual voice. Cher, why don't you share with our listeners the visual voice markers and experience and events in your life? Because this is something we very rarely share on the show. Everybody knows we're artists, but you know, we don't get that personal. But what about your visual voice? Was it easy to find? Tell our listeners.
Well, you know, I think when I started out as a painter, when I realized after high school that painting was a bigger deal than whatever I happened to make when I painted a scene on vacation, that's when I started to look at paintings and began to paint something like my version of the painters that I loved. Color's always been my touchstone, but I know at art school in New York, my paintings were sort of busier and sloppier because we were being taught by the abstract expressionists about the weight of the paint. Also, when we got our supplies list, the brushes were 1-inch bristle brushes, never a number two sable.
Never that expensive.
No, that's true. But we could get cans of oil paint. So that started us right away stretching like 3x4 foot canvases. So we were already being given the tools to make big paintings.
I like that.
Me too. But then when I moved to California, I tried to paint with a loaded brush like the West Coast painters, James Weeks and Richard Diebenkorn, with big brushes and negative space. So I flattened everything. I began to flatten everything. I never really consciously tried to define my visual voice. I wouldn't have thought that far ahead. But everything sort of developed, how I dealt with the edges, with the paint, finding a paint medium that did what I wanted it to, brushes that were the sizes I needed. And when I moved to North Carolina and the color field painters made a big splash or a puddle, I tried to simplify and flatten everything, simple subjects, a chair, table, a mirror, which is all about the atmosphere and the subtle color interactions that produced this atmosphere. I would start out with nothing but a painter's mindset, and I'd go to the 5 and 10 roses in the shopping mall, and some cloth, some color, I would have to paint that, and that would be the start. And then I'd add a plant or a window, a mirror. And for a long time, I did these big spare paintings that were really subtle. And they got subtler and subtler until finally you had to squint to see if there was any real difference happening in these paintings. And I was also drawing figures. We had a drawing group. First, we took turns modeling and then hiring models. I'm still doing that. I don't know why. But
it's good practice, that's why.
But all along, I was working from the last painting until I reached the end and then readjusting. And I'm at that place now of readjustment. My paintings are definitely not like anyone else's, but they're loaded with influences. So there are many ways to start. Well, in the old days, the artists would apprentice in workshops and learn to do everything that a master painter could do and then go out on their own. Now there are artists who are completely educated in the latest development in art.
Yeah, that's important.
Oh, boy. And they put themselves like in the front of the parade, going out on the limb of the unknown, leading the avant-garde. You know, like they're like everybody's going, I'm in front, I'm first.
You're holding the banner for the avant-garde.
Right. So just like Trevor Paglen, who's, we said, currently at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, he's going to have the first space sculpture.
Yeah, he's out there in a unique way. Well, you know, it certainly was a lot more turbulent, my kind of creation of a visual. I mean, I was a medical and biological illustrator for many years, so I was making drawings for doctors and lawyers. You know, I loved medicine, art, and biology, and that was great for making a living in this very specialized field, which combines art and medicine, but it wasn't addressing my nourishment in my soul of what I wanted to say about a creative person. I think that's one of the really important things, to recognize that, mm-hmm. that you're not like satisfying your creative energy. And it wasn't until my early 30s that my voice blossomed, and it wasn't an easy trek. And that's something I, you know, really got to share. I mean, I would stay up at night, you know, in bed. I couldn't sleep. What do I want to say about myself in my world? And the two words that come up about this, and I think this is for a lot of artists in every kind of art genre, is essence and passion. and what is your essence as a person? And they were lacking at that time. Well, I met an artist at Old Dominion University as I was living down there in Norfolk, and he took a look at my drawings of the figure, and he said to me, "Oh, these are really great drawings, but so what?" I remember he said that, like, wow, that knocked me out. And he asked me, "What are you going to do with this stuff? You got really a great skill. You really know how to draw. They're kind of unique and different, but you know what? Every artist can draw the figure. What are you going to say beyond that?" And this was a real eye-opener for me in my early 30s. And it spurred me to go further. What am I going to find? I mean, think about your favorite musicians. They've got a niche that their sound really comes in. And I had to look for mine. Well, since I was getting bored with drawing innards for doctors and lawyers, I kind of got spurred by a global event that perked my interest. And this is really interesting because it was a horrible time for me creatively, and I wanted to address that. Well, believe it or not, there was a war in Yugoslavia that probably many people have forgotten about now, and it was going on for centuries, but suddenly it hit the media, and it was about a country that has been torn apart through war and religious strife. And that was a three-way war in Yugoslavia and tragic on every level possible. And that spurred me on to address something that I was truly part of my essence, art, faith, and spirituality. And the war was going on in the name of God, and everybody was killing each other. And I found that very confusing, that they can actually put God there on the forefront of the battlefield, and they were slaughtering each other. There were crimes against humanity, mass murders, genocide. There was destruction of just about every kind of place of worship, and it destroyed a country on the world stage, and the world looked down in horror. This war took place in a very beautiful country, and it was ruined in a cataclysmic way. Well, for me, that current event actually stimulated my visual voice. It sounds far-fetched, but it was a current event. And I had to dig deep down in my soul about expressing the horrors of war in the name of God, and that was really important to me. So I was reacting to something, although the media at that time was kind of just hemming and whoring about it, but it was very important to me. So I found that voice finally after, you know, many, many years, and it has spurred me on for 30 years. And I'm in a better place emotionally and actually creatively about that, because I latched onto something that was totally unique. And that's the thing. You know, I was dealing with issues of faith and spirituality and art and you know, global current events. And very few people were doing that, especially in the 90s and late 80s. So, but why is it so difficult? I mean, I really struggled with that for so many years.
Well, I think because you were older and you were more aware. I was young and stupid. I just thought, oh, I can paint, but I didn't really think consciously about. What I was saying.
Right, I got you.
Whereas you really were.
Yeah, it was like a need. It was like an imperative to just say something about what the heck's going on in this world.
Yeah. Well, in the Guerrilla Girls Manifesto, which is that feminist artist proclamation, we mentioned it a few programs ago in another show, they say the first proclamation is, the first advantage of being a woman artist is the freedom to work without the pressure of success. So I try to say this without bitterness, and I work on being grateful every day for this blessing. I have no meaningful artist statement about politics or ecology or sustainability or repurposing or feminism, although I will defend these ideas to the death. My work is absolutely about vision, just looking and wandering, so that I can enter into a painting with my whole awareness and block everything else out and open myself to the emotional experience of beauty. It's plain and simple.
And you know, that's so powerful in itself. And I think that's really, really important, that sometimes we lose sight of beauty as the essence to why we create. I mean, that I think that's really happening in the art world more than ever, that sense of beauty. So you're on the right track, Sheila.
All right. Thank you. So just for the record, I've taught art to little kids in every grade up through college and in adult education. I've worked in a leather shop, worked as a house painter and a sign painter, which was great. But I paint in my studio most every day. For the last 30 years, I've been supported financially and every other way by my husband, Peter. So I feel an added responsibility not to squander my time. And my work continues to get better. I surprise myself often. I'm not trying to do anything radical. And believe me, ideas are easy, but beauty is hard. Or there'd be more of it. There'd be more beauty. And in these times, my work is out of style and it may never be different, but it is what I do.
And that's really important, that you're on this journey, you're on this creative road. Well, artists are responding to their world, and sometimes the world presents issues that are confusing and creatively paralyzing to an artist. And then, as Sheila alluded, there's this practical theme of making a living. You know, if you're an artist with a commercial bent, which I actually was, I came from that, you know, you have to satisfy a client, a special audience, and they're basically supporting your art. And this can get sticky and very difficult emotionally for an artist. You have to, you know, keep the customer satisfied, as Simon and Garfunkel said in a fantastic song from the 60s. You got to keep that customer satisfied. Well, keeping the customer happy is a challenge for many artists. It's kind of a tightrope walk, you know, engaging in personal patronage in a relationship and also finding one's voice. So that essence sometimes could become elusive to artists because they're you know, fighting the money train and all that other stuff, and that's happened to me for sure. People have waved the carrot in front of me for money for art's sake, and that kind of confused me. Well, we're going to take a short station break now, and we're going to bounce back on this topic and talk about the shows that Sheila introduced at the beginning of the program. Let's listen to hear from the Flash from the Past, the Moody Blues from the 1980s, with a song appropriately titled "The Voice."
Tell me again.
Welcome back. You're listening to WOWD Tacoma Park, 94.3 FM.
Well, I'd like to take the time to talk about something that helps develop an artist's voice, and that's something called derivative art. Many times young artists start to be inspired from another art form or period, and that kind of gets them kind of going. It kind of juices them to develop their own voice through experience and interest. And this kind of derivative art sometimes has a bad connotation, but I think it's important because many great artists have done this. And it's not necessarily a bad thing in an artist's early career to be doing derivative art, but it could be cumbersome for some, and sometimes it kind of is a way to create a unique voice, but also a way to kind of piggyback too much in an artist's career. Let's think about some artists that have done that, and there's so many. I mean, Constantin Brâncusi, the great Romanian sculptor and artist, was looking at ancient Cycladic art from the Greek islands. Pablo Picasso was looking at the African mask. I mean, that knocked, you know, Pablo Picasso's career up into, you know, vaulted it with many early paintings. And then, of course, we had Paul Gauguin that was looking at Polynesian and Oceanic art to spur on his work. And Michelangelo was absolutely obsessed. I mean, he was like psycho-obsessed about ancient Greek sculpture. And, of course, Carol Walker. I mean, we talked about her in an earlier show. She was fascinated by the French silhouette and how it related to black-white kind of relationships, not only visually, but, you know, emotionally and historically, so on and so forth, in antebellum art. So the list goes on, and I certainly have been using that as a springboard looking at medieval Byzantine art, and that's kind of spurred me on for many, many years. Have you known any artists, Sheila, that have done the same body of work throughout their same career, their whole career? Because I only know a few. It's kind of a very rare thing, doing the same thing all their life. Have you?
Well, I have to say, consistency has been very prized. Like dealers who are looking at your work, they will really, you know, they have to have a recognizable product to sell. And if you start screwing around with that, they're not going to be happy. So it can be a trap, or it could be a way of going deeper. When I look at my work, I can see that I've always been doing the same thing, taking a path a little bit to the left, a little bit to the right. And I can see that I've gotten deeper and better. But it's kind of like looking in a mirror and see yourself, that you're completely familiar to yourself and you're just what you expect. And just like the other day, Peter and I were at a table at the folk festival here, and this guy said to us, "Well, I don't mean anything bad by this, but you guys are old." And I thought, wait, I look about the same to myself. So I think my paintings have had a slow, natural progression. And I haven't ever had any big deal. Like, I have never changed from realism to abstraction.
Right.
I wish sometimes I could, but I just can't. And I've had to learn all these new skills. When I started to think about space, I had to learn the rules of perspective and how to incorporate that into my personal style, how to render space with color. That's a big deal. And my kind of color. And then lettering sometimes comes in, and of course, color theory. But what I say to any new art student is learn everything they have to teach you, because you never know what you'll need. And you need to be able to recognize what you need. So don't reject things just because they're not interesting or, for God's sake, fun. Your mind is just peeking into this, and you have no idea where your work is going to take you.
I think that's such great advice, and thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I think you have to kind of become somewhat of a sponge to take in information, and then you decide and decipher it. But rejecting it on the outset is, I think, it's a very negative attitude for growth and creativity. Mm-hmm. And we certainly know that in the history of art, certain artists have found different paths along the way. Picasso is one of the great examples. I mean, he was everywhere all over the map in his entire career, but yet he found a form of expression. And some of us like to use the word unique, and I've been criticized about being a little too tangential in my career, but you know what? It's just who I am. And especially in the commercial arts, which we really need to talk about here, is like, you know, if you're a fashion or graphic designer, you have to really create a product that's unique. I mean, a look. I mean, that's marketable and that people could say it's you. And I think that's something that's, we like to call branding. You know, you're making a brand. Now, a lot of fine artists don't necessarily have that kind of thing. They don't really call it branding. But in some ways, as you mentioned, a product is a kind of brand. And the gallery owners and the museums are certainly looking for that. And in the fine arts, it's so much more difficult to get this brand. So we have to kind of think about also your process and how it is come that you have that look. So, Sheila, let's get into these exhibitions. Why don't we start with Sean Scully, because he has a look.
All right. He surely does. So Sean Scully, I call Sean Scully the giant. First of all, he's a large man, and he has a kind of a bullying kind of physique. And his paintings are very kind of bullying. They really push you. So if you go to the Hirshhorn, look at these paintings, stand there. Don't think. Just give yourself over to them. Take the first one. It's contradictory to try to explain the experience, which is really beyond words, in words, which is all we have here on the radio. But Scully himself is very careful and precise with his words. He uses the words transformation, ability, talent, sensitive, erotic, proletariat, which is very important in his works. These words have the same weight as his paintings. They are big. They're landscapes, and in that they're made of building slabs of brushed-on color. Some colors come forward, some recede. They're muscular. Scully talks about his work is about relationship, making and unmaking, taking something out of the ground that will live on, grinding it down, mixing it with a medium, and making an image that hopefully will mean something to someone else. He believes talent comes from need. That's a terrific thought. It's about ability for imagination.
Oh, for sure. That's a fantastic thing.
Oh, boy. So Scully was born in Ireland, raised in London, and moved to New York in 1975. Scully's childhood was full of incident. His home life wasn't very happy. His parents fought like cats and dogs. He said, it requires you to make a separate universe to survive your childhood. Scully survived, but at a cost. His determination to escape eventually led him into art. And after he left school, Sean drifted. I was in a street gang. I was a fighter and a criminal. But I got interested in books. Attending evening classes gave him a yearning to go to art school. He was turned down by every art school in London, and he finally won a place at the Croydon College of Art. He said, I really felt that my life had been saved, and I've never wasted a single moment. He fell in love with Francis Bacon and German Expressionism. Everything lit up. I had that same feeling when I got into art school. My life had been saved. His early paintings were technically flawless. They consisted of a complicated grid system of intersecting bands and lines, which formed a rich optical field. The illusion of depth and space is activated by color contrast. The influence of op art is clearly visible. But the thing about Scully is he started out with an ambition to be a great painter and also a successful painter. His early paintings were within the then dominant movement of hard edge abstraction. They are complex layers of space. They're colorful and complicated and move around before your eyes. And somehow they're not that interesting. There's something impersonal about them. The movement of hard edge abstraction used taped edges, and he found that he had to cut the edges loose to be free. Now, that's a painter. He's thinking only in the terms of painting.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And when he began to cut his canvases and shape them so that he could add blocks of color, maybe a square within stripes of a different scale inset into the original canvas, the spaces, so simple in their drawing, have a kind of subjective universality. As he said, it's all about relationship. They are abstract in the best sense in that there's nothing in the way, images or words or direction. Like any relationship, he says, sometimes they drive him crazy. And sometimes he likes them. I like this relationship. I still have this color in mind in one of his stacked slabs, this light dead gray red at the bottom of a stack of slabs. And that color drove me crazy. I keep thinking about it because it's awful.
Oh, and it's good that you're haunted by the art.
Yeah, absolutely. These landline paintings at the Hirshhorn are landscapes. It's in that taken together, they have a horizon line, building slabs with light peeking through the edges, and the strongest ones like seascapes with heavy, ominous clouds and sea. He's going for the experience of looking and absorbing light, atmosphere, the experience of the land, the experience of the sea, and the show is spectacular. There is a piece of paper that he wrote in Chelsea about this landline series. Landline, something coming. I painted it on a quiet Sunday in Chelsea. There was an immense sadness in and around me, in the plants, the living things, the material of the studio. My life has been a storm of great sorrow and great love. Landlines stand for edges.
He's a very eloquent, and you know, I mean, there's a rawness and eloquence that I really enjoy in Sean Scully. And there's also a beautiful quote from 2006 that he said. He said, "I remember growing up in Ireland and everything being checkered, even the fields and the people." And I think that's so amazing, mm-hmm. because when I look at the work, it's so apparent to me that these paintings are landscapes of stripes of fields and grids of fields of agriculture that one can see from a plane. And that's always fascinated me when you look down at an agricultural field from the plane. Well, there's a crudeness to them and in the process which speak to me about the rawness of clay, earth, and the union with the sky and the sea. And I think that's where Sean Scully knocks me between the eyes. This patterning in his work takes on the landscape and also conjures up things like a Scottish plaid, a tweed, a fabric, bolts of color that are rolled out, handmade and checkered, and vibrating color next to each other. So there's a lot about the British and Irish Isles in these, and I believe his tremendous career truly shows his essence. And the show really kind of gets that. I mean, there's a look, a palette, a temperature of the paintings. And I think that makes that show really powerful. And Sean Scully, a really powerful artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really interesting to me looking at some videos of him painting that he uses like a 5 or a 6 inch brush so that he can cover large areas really fast. So he can be very facile moving stuff around.
Go ahead.
I also love his pastels because they have a different quality. They tend to be subtler and I would say more beautiful.
Interesting, because you know he really is an amazing marvel to watch when he mm-hmm. as he's painting. And the big brush is an extension of this big body. Mm-hmm. And there's something very poetic about it. There's something about the rough and tumble nature of this giant with the tools on the canvases. And I think his rawness is just so damn honest.
Yeah.
It's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
So let's go on to Richard Tuttle.
Well, Richard Tuttle, I call him the Sprite. Well, I was thinking of calling him the Mouse, but I think the Sprite is more dignified. Well, Sean Scully is a big man. He's lumbering. He wears a white, cover-up suit. Richard Tuttle is fine-boned, he's slender, he's hyper-intelligent, and he's also a master of words. He says that poetry keeps language alive, that words are the best and the worst. His work is also abstract, but he deals with the most subtle of relationships, he could put a string between two nails and its shadow on the wall, and that's what you're looking at. Tuttle is playful. Everything counts. The way he fills in the space with the brush between two pencil lines, or he's using maybe a quarter-inch brush and delicate transparent paint washes. Tuttle says that art is a system that produces freedom, that the artist does something that society would never do. His purpose is to help you see what exists. He said, "Whenever I see a work of art, everything I believe comes true." That is, to me, I could put that on my mirror, so I read it every day. I felt this way myself. It's the best reason for looking at art. He believes that suffering leads to consciousness. This particular show of Tuttle's is part of a series, Intersections, at the Phillips Collection. An artist is invited to look through their collection. They can go in the vaults, and they use the pieces they pick as a starting point for the work that they improvise there at the museum. Tuttle decided every morning for 41 days to write the first words that came to him as he was waking up, and created a 41-verse poem. These are carefully hand-lettered on papers above each piece. Just the way he letters with a slight painstaking awkwardness. I love the first part of the show. It looks like Tuttle went scouring the alleys in DuPont Circle, picking up things that were in the trash. I'm sure that is what he did, and made what he called, unfortunately, assemblages. It's in the tradition of Kurt Schwitters and the beginning of what we call installation art, and Robert Rauschenberg very much. But after a while, these tiny constructions and their relationship to the words were more difficult for me to understand. I felt that he was working in a space that was inaccessible to me, except for the last terrific piece made out of cut-up tree limbs hanging from the ceiling, crunched together with these beautiful fluttering green latex gloves. How did he do it? How did he hang it? You know, I promise you that I was at the dentist 2 days ago, and she had those green latex gloves, and I said, "Oh my God, that's latex gloves. I've never really seen them outside of the sculpture." And she said, "I love this color. I ordered my couch this color."
Oh, goodness gracious.
So I'm going back this week to give it another try. The drawings that Tuttle chose from the Phillips collection are perfect. A small pencil line drawing by Arthur Dove that is as spare as Tuttle's drawings, and a drawing in the woods by Ensert that's so immediate. He was sitting there among the trees, delicately, faithfully recording his experience, and the figure drawing by Richard Diebenkorn, which is one of my favorite drawings anywhere.
Well, one of the things about this show, it's on Visual Voice, and I'm actually not sure that Richard Tuttle has a visual voice. I mean, there's a wildly enigmatic order in the work, but it kind of, when you look at it from and step back, I saw it as a map of like kitsch. And studying Richard Tuttle's work is a fantastic lesson in design and the basic elements of design for beginning students. But he's a terrible example for an artist to look at visual voice. And he's a brilliant guy, but, you know, I enjoy the variety and the quirkiness in it, but I feel it's like I was in a junk shop looking for that special thing in a heap of all that good stuff. And in that stuff, I had to really take something home with me. And I did. I took a little something home with me. But it's kind of like the best picks of a culture vulture's treasure hunt. And I'm not sure that kind of that works with any kind of voice for me. So I'm looking at the show, and we're really running out of time. So what about that comparison, Sheila, between Sean Scully and Richard Tuttle?
Yeah, well, I'm fascinated that just coincidentally these two shows, they have so much to compare. It's just an unavoidable comparison. They, like many artists, were raised in a situation that really had nothing to do with who they were. There's an amazing book and now a film called Far From the Tree by Andrew Solomon. It's a study of children with disabilities, blindness, deafness, dwarfism, autism, and even prodigies who are born to normal parents. And it's about how the parents respond to raising these kids. It's a great book, and it's so meaningful to me. Maybe Andrew Solomon, who is gay and now has has a child with his partner, along with a couple of other tangential children that make up his family, should have included a chapter on artists because of the response to an alienating home. Finding refuge in making things and becoming artists surely fits in here. Scully says that he thinks that talent is driven by need. Richard Tuttle avoids any familiar form for these installations. If you look at a detail, when you first look at it, you were kind of appalled by the garbage aspect. But then you keep looking, you see the beauty. But artists are required to package it into a form, like a frame, a subject, a philosophy, an idea. Tuttle has no package. It's up to you to find the beauty in these relationships. It is there. I myself got led away from the relationship of words and constructions. In the beginning, I thought I could see a relationship, and I could, the constructions and the words, but I got tired of trying to find it as I went on. I'm going to go back, and I'll let you know if I end up agreeing with Tom, but I'm not going to say yet.
Okay, Sheila, I'll let you go on that one. But you remember the great expression, somebody's crap is someone else's treasure? Mm-hmm. And I think this is perfect for Richard Tuttle. And he does a great job in resurrecting the benign and the wasted and turning it into something beautiful. And there's a great power and gift in that kind of thing. So we're going to close now, and I'll remind you that the Sean Scully Show Landslide is at the Hirshhorn through February 2019, and then Richard Tuttle show entitled Intersections. Richard Tuttle is, it seems like it's going to be, is at the Phillips Collection, and that goes through December 30th. Sheila, why don't you tell our listeners about our upcoming shows?
Yeah, I'd love to. Okay, well, Tom and I will be putting on a series of the development of an artist and how a visual artist views their success from the beginning of their art career to the mid-career until their late and hopefully productive life in advancing age. This is a very big topic, and we hope to tackle it soon. But I have to right now say that I was so fortunate, because of doing this radio show, to be included in the media event yesterday at the Glenstone Museum. It's brand new. It's open to the public in October, and it's one of the most incredible experience that I have ever had in a museum.
Well, the Glenstone is one of the area's great treasures, and we'll bring our listeners to the Glenstone in a few weeks with a great show about their new addition to their fantastic museum. And it's going to be very exciting, but stay tuned to WWDLP Tacoma Park, and let's listen to Bobby Hill and this music coming right up after our show. And it's every Saturday from 10 to 1 p.m. Avant-garde jazz right here. Keep that dial fixed for Bobby to take over and give you that jazzy vibe this Saturday afternoon. Experience art and the visual and everything you do. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Just to do